All right, so this is Dr. Shivaya Dure. I'm an MIT PhD. I'm a scientist, inventor, engineer, and entrepreneur. I have 4 degrees from MIT, but most importantly, I'm an expert in a field called system science and pattern analysis. I've started a bunch of companies on the education side and on research side. I'm a Fulbright scholar, a Lemelson MIT Awards finalist, and also a nominee for the National Medal of Technology and Innovation. But what I want to talk to you about today is my journey to begin with, you know, my journey to running for United States Senate. And that journey actually begins in another country, in another land called India. So I grew up in two very different worlds, so I had to really start looking at understanding systems at a young age. I grew up, you know, in a scene like this in Bombay, which was a very eclectic world of, you know, many languages, many castes, many religions, and these are some scenes of that Bombay that I grew up in. You know, in one scene you could see from bullock carts to people in Armani suits and trains and everything. But I also grew up in a very different world in India. A third of my life was spent in a deep South Indian village where the world was everyday poor farmers. In fact, my grandparents were village farmers. My grandmother would work around 16 hours a day in these rice paddy fields. Grew up in India where there was a caste system. It was essentially racism on steroids. You know, my family was considered untouchable as the lowest of the low. And in that world, there was a hierarchy where there was the elites on the top, typically was known as a priesthood, then the kings and the warriors, and then essentially the untouchables who did all the work. So by that caste system, my family was supposed to be coconut pickers for the rest of their lives. Every caste had a particular job. So it was quite extraordinary that a mom and my dad even made it to the United States. Now, one of the reasons my parents came here was because of the freedom, the equality, but also the concept of one person, one vote, that everyone was treated as a whole human being. In the caste system, you were treated less than a human being. So in 1970, at the age of 7, I literally left India on my 7th birthday in 1970, and my parents landed in Kennedy Airport. By the way, my dad came first. We didn't see my dad for about a year, so talk about family separation, but that's what you went through. It was a great honor to come to this country. But given what I had experienced as a child in India, I worked extremely hard because I knew the amazing opportunities that America afforded people like us. So by the time I was 14, I had finished calculus, which was in the ninth grade what high school students, the seniors were taking. And my high school didn't have any other courses to offer me. Now, very interestingly, my mom, who was an amazing person, saw this little article a friend had given her in a New York newspaper. And a friend of hers said, hey, you should, Meena, look at this. My mom's name was Meena Meenakshi. And maybe Shiva would be interested. And what this was New York University in those days was the Courant Institute of Mathematical Sciences, one of probably the world's leading mathematical sciences institute, had decided they were going to bring in 40 students. This is in 1978 when software was just a new phenomenon. And 40 students, high school students, would get selected to go to NYU to study an intensive, almost a Navy SEAL-like computer science program. So I was very fortunate as one of those 40 students selected. And my dear mom would drop me off at the Newark train station at 5, 6 a.m. and I'd take the train into New York. Alone. You know, most parents today are afraid to send their kids down the street. But during that very intensive program, I graduated top of the class, and this was at NYU with distinction. And then high school was still coming up, but I had really no other math courses to take. So I got a full-time job, believe it or not, working as a research fellow while I was finishing up high school in what is now known as Rutgers University. At that time it was known as a College of Medicine and Dentistry in the heart of Newark, New Jersey. So think about that. So I would go into Newark as a young kid and work as a full-time research fellow. It was unheard of in those days, but I was afforded this because of what America had to offer me, the fact that they recognize the meritocracy system, and I was given a job to work with people 30 to 50 years older than me. I was a 14-year-old kid. I'd walk in there very professionally. And the deal with me and my boss was that as long as I worked as a professional, I'd be treated as an equal. So my initial work there was looking at sleep patterns of babies. There's a very interesting disease called sudden infant death syndrome where babies die in their sleep. So I was given the task of looking at sleep patterns and trying to figure out, could I write computer programs to figure out when that baby would potentially stop breathing. And this was called SIDS, or what was known as an apnea. So while I was doing that, a lot of people recognized my capability in computing, and I was given another very interesting task. Anyone over the age of 40 listening right now would probably know that in those days, in the 70s, the way most organizations worked was they had another system called the inter-office mail system. And this was where every office had a secretary in this medical school, and the secretary always was a woman. On her desk was an inbox, outbox, folders, and she would write this thing called a memo, very structured, to, from, subject, the carbon paper. So if she was writing a memo, let's say to hire someone, she would put to, from, subject, and then she would put a piece of carbon paper, she was going to CC it to her boss, and then she would write this thing called a memo and maybe even attach the person's resume, which was called an attachment. And then this was put into these little yellow envelopes, some of you may remember this, and it was sent around in these pneumatic tubes. And this was, again, a very powerful system. And I was asked to convert this entire system into the electronic form. It had never been done before. I wrote 50,000 lines of code in a mathematical programming language called Fortran, and I named that system email. Now, one of the things people should recognize is the experts of the time working in the military thought this was an impossible problem. In fact, this was an Iran report written by a guy called David Crocker saying it would be impossible to create a system like this. So because they never thought everyday people like secretaries could even have a system that they could ever use. But I didn't, because I respected the secretaries and I went on to do this problem, and I named this system email. Only one reason, because the operating system in those days only allowed 5 characters. So it's not an obvious term. And won a number of awards, was recognized as in 1980, you can see this paper clipping, won one of the Westinghouse Science Awards, which is now known as the Intel Awards. And all of this was possible because of what America had to offer. And this was all done before I went to MIT. When I went to MIT, I was deeply interested in systems. In fact, when I arrived at MIT, about 1,041 students arrived at MIT that year. 3 of those students were highlighted in the front page of the newspaper, and I was one of them for having created this email system. It was quite extraordinary because MIT recognized the importance of this innovation. That year, 1981, I was elected student body president, and the president of MIT invited me to his home, and he said, "Shiva, it's too bad the software cannot be patented." His name was Dr. Gray. He was on Reagan's Science Advisory Council, and he advised me to copyright the software. So on August 30th, 1982, which is what I did, I was issued the first U.S. copyright for email, for inventing email, at a time when copyright was the only way to get intellectual property protection for software. So that's really the story of the invention of email, but more importantly, my journey to engineering at a young age. But what I learned about building email, about systems, because email was ultimately a system. We're not talking about exchanging text messages. We're talking about email, the system as we know it today. That's what I created. But because of my interest in systems, because of what I'd seen my grandmother do, I had a deep interest, again, in computing the body as a large-scale system. So what's important about the email story is it leads to why I got more interested in politics, because in 2011, when my dear mom was dying, in a suitcase she had saved all of these artifacts of the invention of email. In a suitcase, Time Magazine came. This is almost 35 years later. The editor of Time Magazine, senior editor Doug Ammuth, reviewed this, and he said, you know, this is a man who invented email, wrote a big article. And then it went into the Smithsonian on February 16, 2012. And one would think this would be a huge appreciation of the American dream. It went in, and what occurred after that was quite fascinating. And it was one of the reasons that compelled me to get involved in politics, because I started recognizing in America we were getting into an elitist caste-like system. And what happened here was, when it went into the Smithsonian, the liberal elites got very, very upset that how dare this guy claim he invented email. It could have only occurred at places like MIT or the military. And you see this huge vitriol come in newspapers like Gawker, et cetera, calling me a fraud, all sorts of horrible names. That journey took me to a process of recognizing that though that invention was created before MIT, it bothered people that it did not occur at a place like MIT. So you see companies like Raytheon, which had taken credit for the invention of email after that. And those are the people who spurred this controversy on. And one of the important things to understand is that, and this comes into what's happening today as we talk about election fraud, is this is about 10 years ago. When this news came out, Wikipedia would not allow my page to be edited, would not allow any type of changes to take place, because the theory was that great inventions must only come from, you know, institutions. So you had finally people like a liberal philosopher like Noam Chomsky, who came out and looked at it, and he said it's clear that a 14-year-old kid invented email. But more importantly, what you find is the liberal elites were starting to, at that time, started putting out very interesting. A book came out by Walter Isaacson, who wrote the book on Steve Jobs. And what Walter Isaacson said was that, you know, all great innovations come out of the military industrial academic complex. In a book he wrote right in the heat of this battle, you can see the kinds of people that he said innovate. And you can see the pictures here, and it's quite obvious that none of them could be anyone who came from outside the bounds of large institutions like MIT. And what you see here is that in Isaacson's book, he attributes all great innovations to what he identifies as the golden triangle of the military-industrial academic complex. And that 14-year-old kid doesn't belong in that triangle. So what people didn't know is that I had a history of also fighting while I was at MIT, organizing separate newspapers, organizing people to fight for people's rights. Here's a picture of me on my PhD graduation fighting for the United States to get out of Iraq. But the reason this is important is that I used that fighting energy to finally find an attorney called Charles Harder. We sued Gawker Media for $35 million, and I was successful. The three defamatory articles were pulled down. I was awarded close to $1 million in settlement. But what emerged out of that, and this is around 2016 now, is that I had started to see that the United States was becoming a very elitist caste system-like model as what my parents left India for. So that compelled me to run for United States Senate in 2018. And the GOP I ran as a Republican. The GOP establishment in Massachusetts had already picked their anointed guy. So I was forced to run as an independent against a woman called Elizabeth Warren. And we had a very populist campaign, and the slogan was only the real Indian could defeat the fake Indian. And we had an amazing bus. This campaign went viral. We got close to 100,000 votes in spite of the GOP establishment interference, 5 times more votes than any U.S. Senate independent candidate in Massachusetts history. In the middle of this, we also noticed another important thing that was taking place in America, the attack on free speech, the attack on the First Amendment. I went to a rally to expose Elizabeth Warren, and a guy wearing a shirt called liberal punched me in the face because I dared call Elizabeth Warren a racist. So, as a part of one of these events, one of the big events that took place in Boston was on August 19th, 2017, is I had organized a free speech rally on the Boston Commons. Well, the mayor of Boston, who is now, Marty Walsh, who's now been nominated to be the Secretary of Labor, called our free speech rally a racist right-wing rally and said that I was a white supremacist and a Nazi. And he got 40,000 people to show up to this rally. 40 of us versus 40,000 people thinking they were coming to protest a white supremacist, which was me, and 40 of our people. And if you look at these pictures here, it's literally 40,000 people came after us, and it was us and the Boston police facing off. Well, what did my talk talk about? My talk on the Boston Common talked about free speech, the need to support the First Amendment, but more importantly, that we needed to unify left and right in a way that was Black Lives Do Matter. We need to start talking about many of the big issues of academic free speech was being violated. So the net of it was, that was our U.S. Senate 2018 campaign. But in 2020, I decided to also run as a Republican. I said, you know what, I'm going to give the Republicans a shot. I will not switch to independent. I will run. I made a commitment to the Republican Party to run as a Republican. And that election was quite extraordinary. We had lawn signs everywhere. We had close to 10,000 lawn signs. It's a great measure of, you know, the efficacy of a campaign. We had close to 20,000 bumper stickers. We had volunteers everywhere, close to 3,000 volunteers, billboard ads, radio, TV. We raised about $1.6 million bottoms up. And what is important about this campaign to understand is the opponent was a guy who no one knew of, was not an incumbent in politics, that the GOP establishment, who hated Trump, had decided to put against me to ensure that I wouldn't go after the Democrat Markey. What needs to be understood in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts GOP head of it is a guy called Charlie Baker, the governor, who hates President Trump. He said he was not going to vote for him. So I was in the swamp of the swamp in many ways. And in that swamp, here I was, a supporter of the president, running on a populist ticket with 3,000 volunteers on the ground. So we knew by September 1st, 2020, which was the primary election, that we were going to win on a landslide, just by the fact this other guy was nowhere. So what happens on September 1st, 2020? What occurs is in Franklin County, which is one of the counties, as you can see here, which 80% of the votes are hand counted, which means paper ballots. So there's two ways an election can take place, at least in Massachusetts and pretty much in the United States, is that you can vote with a paper ballot and it is counted by human beings without the use of machines. Franklin County, close to 80 to 90% of the ballots are hand counted, paper ballots. Now, in every other county, they typically use electronic voting machines. Well, we win by 10 points in Franklin County, and in every other county, I lose in a very interesting number, 60-40, 60-40, 60-40, 60-40. And you have to understand, this other guy had no lawn signs, no bumper stickers, was nowhere to be found. People didn't even know who he was. This guy wins black neighborhoods, Hispanic neighborhoods. It was a man for all seasons. So we knew something was up. And so my concession speech that evening on September 1st was that election fraud took place in Massachusetts, and I'm glad we have the Second Amendment. And that started my journey as a scientist, as a systems guy, as a mathematician, to figure out what had actually occurred in Massachusetts. I had heard about election fraud in places like third world countries, but I never thought it would take place in the United States. So what I want to explain here, the explanation here is really going to help you understand how these electronic voting machines work and how fraud actually takes place using these machines. So first of all, let's take a simple look at this box. This is called a system, okay? Now, what's fascinating about a system, all systems have an input and they have an output, very simple. And in the case of electronic voting systems, the input is very simple, right? It's the people, it's P, the number of people actually voting. They could be voting, early voting, mail-in ballots, or physically coming. So let's use the variable P to denote the number of people voting, the participating voters. And the output of that machine is denoted by this variable V, which is a votes cast, okay? So P is the people who actually vote, and V is the number of ballots or votes cast. Now, every town typically keeps a list by law called a participating voters list, which literally lists every voter who cast a ballot. And you would think that P should equal V, right? That the number of people voted should equal the number of votes. So when we started exploring this in Massachusetts, we had our volunteers start issuing FOIAs, which public records requests to be specific, and we issued them to around 50-20 towns randomly. About seven towns responded back, and you can see these towns here: Boston, Lawrence, New Bedford, Plymouth, Newton, Barnstable, Rockland. And what you see here is the first column here is the actual number of participating voters, which means the people who actually voted. The next column here is the actual number of ballots cast. Remember, we're not making these numbers up. This is from the towns giving us their data after we had to pull teeth. In fact, we had to take 20 people into City Hall. We had to have a huge fight with them, with police and everything. And finally, the office gave us these numbers. And what you see in this last column is a discrepancy. You see that there's more votes than voters. In fact, in Boston, there's 4,114 more votes than voters. In a town called Newton, 1,780 more votes than voters. So every town we looked at, P does not equal V, okay? Quite fascinating. So more votes than voters. Remember, in my view, the election officials, you know, I write software, many of you do very hard skilled jobs. These guys just get paid to vote. I mean, paid to count votes. And they can't even get the number of votes to match with the number of voters. So what we found out was P was not matching V. So we started exploring more and we found out that these machines actually have a feature in there called the weighted race feature. And you have to listen to this very carefully. It's called the weighted race feature. Am I making this up? Well, what this means is that V, which is the number of ballots cast, can actually be the number of people that came in multiplied by a weight, W. And the only way V, which is the ballots cast, can equal P is if that weight is 1, which means they're not applying any weights to it. However, let's say they decide to multiply my votes by 0.5, which means a number less than 1, or multiply by my opponents by 2. That means the weight W is less than 1, or it's something greater than 1. So in that case, P is never going to equal V. So is this possible? Well, here's what's fascinating. I was fortunate, with the help of some friends, to go find the Diebold manual. Why is Diebold important? Diebold is a company which is sort of the grandfather of all these electronic voting machines. So this is the Diebold manual, page 2-126. In fact, this is a manual from November 1st, 2002. You can go look it up. So this is the Diebold manual. On page 2-126 is it's a documented feature. It's called the weighted race feature. Weighted race feature. And what does that say? It says weighted races are tallied by weights assigned from the voter registration and may be counted in the central vote centers. So what that means is, let's say you got 1,000 votes. Let's say you got 1,000 votes and I got 1,000 votes. They can multiply your votes by 2, and they can multiply my votes by 0.5. So you get 2,000 votes, I get 500 votes. This is a feature. It's a documented feature in the Diebold systems. And we'll come back to this. Now, you may say, well, that's only in 2002. Is that in the modern voting systems? And you're going to see shortly, that's in fact in the 2019 Dominion manual, they also have that same feature. Okay? So this is a feature that you can multiply votes by a factor. It's built into the system. So again, look here. So in hand-counted Franklin County, I got 54%. I won. But in every other town, 60-40, 60-40, 60-40, all of those other towns, 80 to 90% of the votes are counted by electronic voting machines. So when I found this out, on September 9th, I went to the Secretary of State and I issued a public records request. What I found out about this, just to step back a little bit, I found out that in electronic voting machines, when a ballot goes in, this is very, very important to understand this, when a ballot goes in a paper ballot, the machines always create something called a ballot image. It's a scan of the ballot. A ballot image gets created. It's a picture. That ballot image is what is actually tabulated. So it's not the paper ballot. It's a ballot image. So when someone fills in the circle for Shiva and someone fills in the circle for somebody else, the machine scans that ballot, creates a ballot image, and when it comes to tabulate, it is literally using its quote-unquote AI software and looking for those dots and then deciding, A, if the, first of all, the ballot was legitimate, and then it counts it. If it was not legitimate, that goes to what's called adjudication. Okay? So at that point, when these ballot images are, when the electronic voting machines scan the ballot and create the ballot image, that is when a weighted race feature could be implemented. So what's very important is you must have those ballot images, because the ballot images are evidence, can be evidence of if the computer algorithm of weighted race was turned on. So ballot images, by the way, must be preserved by 52 U.S.C. 20701. The government for federal elections passed a law in around 1974 saying any records generated in connection with a federal election must be preserved for 22 months. I'll repeat that again. Any records generated in connection with a federal election must be preserved for 22 months. Well, if you put a paper ballot in, the image did not exist before. It gets generated by the machine, along with the what's called the cast vote records and the list vote records and the log files. These are all supposed to be saved for a federal election. So when I found this out, I went to the Secretary of State and with two of my volunteers with a camera, and I gave my FOIA. I said, I want all the ballot images, I want the cast vote records, I want the list vote records, and I want the log files. The election official behind the desk said, we don't save that data. We turn that feature off. And by the way, we have this on video. So anyway, I said, look, I want these, and you're expected to save them by federal law. Anyway, They had 10 days to respond. On September 24th, I get a letter from the state election director, Michelle Tassinari, who is also the general counsel for the Massachusetts Secretary of State, a guy called Bill Galvin. And in that letter to me, she tells me that we don't have to save ballot images by Massachusetts law. In fact, she tells me that they don't have to save them. And then so I write back an email and say, please tell me the Massachusetts statute. The next email I get back from her is not answering that question, simply saying, we don't have to save them, we have the paper. So I write her back an email saying, you know, you violated federal law, the election is null and void. Those four emails, this is on September 25th, a very important point of fact here, between September 1st and September 25th, I had been tweeting out on Twitter that that ballot images were destroyed. And by the way, Twitter didn't do anything to me. I was on Twitter since 2011. Never was I banned from Twitter. But the instant I put up those four emails exposing the fact that the Secretary of State of Massachusetts is admitting that they had deleted ballot images, within minutes, I am banned from Twitter. Not for one day, but for 21 days. And I had moved my campaign to a write-in campaign. So for nearly the entire rest of the federal election campaign, I am banned off Twitter for 21 days. And as you can see here, these are the tweets that I shared, those four emails on Twitter. So this forced me, and by the way, what I was sharing in those tweets was that the Secretary of State of Massachusetts had violated federal law by deleting those ballot images. So what we found out was one of the quote-unquote fact-checking organizations, I believe they're funded by Soros, someone should check this out, called Lead Stories. They had said Dr. Shiva was spreading election misinformation, ballots were not destroyed. I said ballot images. But in that article, they had said that the Secretary of State had contacted Twitter to shut me down. So I knew I had a very important lawsuit. It's hard to sue Twitter on Section 230, but I knew I could sue the Secretary of State for violating my First Amendment, because this is the foundation of America, political speech. No lawyer in Massachusetts wanted to take this on, so I had to file this lawsuit on my own, a federal lawsuit. And that federal lawsuit asked for two things. First, it was a lawsuit for about $1.2 billion against the Secretary of State. But more importantly, I asked for a restraining order because I was in the middle of a federal election saying that I no longer wanted the Secretary of State to contact Twitter. So that case, number one victory, was a judge decided to hear that case. And it was me against three lawyers, Harvard-trained attorney general, assistant attorney general. And I argued the fact that the state had induced Twitter to shut me down. And I showed the facts of that. In fact, what came out in this case during cross-examination between me and the judge was that the Secretary of State, the judge asked the Secretary of State, why didn't you simply just go on Twitter if you didn't like what Dr. Shiva had to say and simply tweet against him? He said, you know, I may be old, but I still believe in the First Amendment. And it turned out that the Secretary of State, using their Twitter account here, had contacted Twitter to told them to shut me down. Yep. So what you see in this testimony is that the judge asks the state election director, what was your purpose? And she said, I think the goal was generally to ensure that misinformation wasn't being spread. And so whatever actions that we could take to make sure that the tweet was labeled as inaccurate or taken down, we were willing to pursue. They are admitting that they were willing to pursue anything to take down that tweet, which was exposing the fact that the Secretary of State was deleting ballot images, which is a violation of federal law. And then the witness went on to say, which is the state election director, I believe I saw that it had been removed. I was, yes, relieved. So when Twitter, after their contacting them, did this, they were quite relieved. In fact, it turns out, what came out in testimony, as you can see here, that the election division of Massachusetts is a Twitter partner. Everyone should understand this, because in this case, they were saying that anyone could have contacted against Dr. Shiva's tweet. But it turns out that the state election directors of every state in the United States has a Twitter partnership. In fact, it's called a trusted Twitter partnership. And as you can see here, what came out in here was that it said, my understanding is that we were able to select certain reasons for reporting a tweet that may not be available to everyone, and that they will, that the people who review the tweets at Twitter, when complaints are made, will try to act quickly on the ones we report. So that means not all of us are created equal, according to Twitter. When the state election director contacted Twitter, it was like the bat phone that they have access to, and that so they're essentially at a higher level than us, okay? An upper caste, one may say, and that was used to shut me down on Twitter. And more importantly, the Secretary of State here acknowledges, the judge asked her, but you do know that the four tweets I asked her that I shared with you and I interacting about the ballot images were removed. Is that right? And she admits yes. So in testimony, what came out was that the Secretary of State and another organization called NASID, the National Association of State Election Directors, a nonprofit organization, was also contacted by the Secretary of State of Massachusetts. A phone call went into Amy Cohn, who's the executive director of NASED, which is where all the state election directors across America congregate. And why are the state election directors important? Because they're the ones who certify voting machines. They're the ones who certify that the weighted race feature can exist in those voting machines. And the National Association of State Election Directors, as you can see here, this is right off their website, is funded by very, very billionaire families, including the Rockefellers, the Murdochs, etc. So not only did the Secretary of State use their trusted Twitter partnership to shut me down off Twitter, but they also contacted NASID. And NASID also, according to the Secretary of State Election Director, also contacted Twitter. So what's important to understand here was they have a trusted Twitter partnership. They worked to conceal the fact that ballot images were destroyed. And they admitted to taking down my tweets, and they would do whatever it took to do that because they did not want the public to know that ballot images are more important than paper ballots and they violated federal law. This is central because on electronic voting machines, the ballot images are more important than the paper ballots. They are the ballots because they are what is counted. They are what is actually tabulated. So in my federal lawsuit, it was me against three lawyers representing myself pro se. The great thing was the judge gave us all terms of the restraining order. As you can see here, he said that the Secretary of State is barred from contacting Twitter until the end of that general election, and that the Secretary of State will also contact NASID and tell them no longer to contact Twitter, and that if they have any issues that they will go on Twitter. This is a huge victory. This is a victory for free speech and the First Amendment. More importantly, because I was given all the terms of the restraining order, it sets a precedent saying that I will likely win the entire lawsuit. Judges do not like to give terms of restraining orders or restraining orders unless they know you have merit for the entire case. So this was a big victory for free speech. But more importantly, it exposed the fact that the Secretaries of State and the Association of Election Directors do not want you, the public, to know that they actually are deleting ballot images, which violates federal law, violates USC 52 USC 20701. All right, so that was our first lawsuit. Now, why are the ballot images important? It's because my hope was that with the ballot images, I could show that the computer algorithms are on, okay? Here the Secretary of State is unwilling to give me the ballot images, and so I had to now put on my hat as a pattern recognition guy, which is what I've been studying pretty much my entire life across all the degrees at MIT. So this was quite providential because I could apply all my mathematical basis, all my pattern recognition expertise to actually start figuring out, could I figure out if the computer algorithms were turned on and what they actually were, okay? So in order to explain that to you, again, a quick lesson here. Going back to the system diagram, remember every system has an input, every system has an output. All systems have a state. A state could be a normal state, and I'll give you an example of this, or a state could be an abnormal state. This is going to be very, very important when we start understanding election fraud. So this is the fundamentals of it. So you could have a normal state or an abnormal state. Let me give you a simple example. If you happen to go get your EKG taken, your cardiovascular system, So here's a picture of your heart, you know, or your body wired up. And typically, the pattern that comes out of that EKG machine should look something like this. This is what's called a normal QRST complex, okay? This is the normal pattern. Now, if your heart is having what's called ventricular fibrillation, it's not going to look like that pattern. It's going to look like a simple sinusoid. So this is the abnormal state, right? Normal state, abnormal state. So in pattern analysis, which is a very rich field, it's not just math, it's math. There's some expertise involved in it by domain. You're trying to figure out what the normal pattern is or the abnormal patterns, okay? That's the field of pattern analysis. So this was great because election fraud, we need to figure out what the normal pattern is, what the abnormal pattern is, because that's at the heart of detecting fraud. So for example, for me, again, it's important for credibility given that this is such a hot issue with election fraud. Let me just give you sort of the gravitas of my background in this. If you recall, I told you 1978 as a 14-year-old kid, I was looking at sleep patterns of babies. So here's a baby, which is a system. We're looking for sleep patterns, which are the signals. Certain sleep patterns are normal, others are abnormal. When I first came to MIT, I did a research called TEDOMA, how deaf-blind people communicate. Again, there are different signals that come out of your speech patterns, which are your mouth, your jaw, your upper lip, lower lip. Again, you can figure out what people are saying watching these speech patterns. This is called pattern analysis. For my one of the NSF science projects I worked on while at MIT, we looked at sending signals into a bridge and looking at the signals that came back. That way we could figure out if the bridge was in good shape or it had salt erosion or there was cement erosion. Again, this is an application of pattern analysis. Here's another example. We could send a signal into a F-15's wing. And based on the signal coming back, we could detect normal patterns, whether the wing was okay or whether it had problems in it. Because you obviously don't want to go break up a wing, destroy it, if there's nothing wrong with it. And then one of the things I do right now in one of my companies called Cytosolve, we have complaints about a website, people wanting refunds. Again, a rich background in pattern analysis. So when the election fraud issue came, I was very fortunate because I went back to my background, my patents I had done in pattern analysis where we could extract a feature of a signal. And I'll show you an example with voter fraud, what we did in Massachusetts, Michigan, Georgia, as well as in Arizona. And we could literally cluster these patterns together. And then we could figure out the signal. So face analysis, where you figure out certain features of the face to create a signal, and then you can figure out the normal state and the abnormal state. So again, here in the system, in Massachusetts, we were very, very fortunate. So we applied all of this pattern analysis skill, which has been about 32 years of my training, 40 years of my training, 40 years of my training, in looking at the election system. And what we found was, we got very lucky. We call it a unicorn in pattern analysis. In Suffolk County, as you're seeing in this graph here, Suffolk County is interesting. Very, very low number of Republican voters. But we were able to see a very important pattern. What you see in this pattern is that you see high, low number of votes. And what we're seeing in this pattern is on the x-axis, we're looking at the number of votes, and the y-axis is the number of precincts having those number of votes. So in the first case, what you see here is you see nearly 26 precincts having one vote. Then you see about 10 precincts which only deliver two votes to me. Then you see a little bit close to 30 precincts delivering three votes. And then you see 10 precincts delivering four votes. So what you see is up, down, up, down, up, down, high, low, high, low, high, low, high, low pattern. Let me tell you, and it's always 2-1, which means twice as many odd votes than even votes. This would be like you going to a casino and throwing the dice. Let's say you throw a dice. You should get 50% odd, 50% even. Here we're noticing double the number of odds to even numbers. And more importantly, it's going high, low, high, low, high, low over time. So what we did was we took this pattern and we used the computer to see what would be the possibility of getting high, low, high, low, high, low patterns like this. In fact, there was a sequence of 9. And you find out that this pattern can only be possible, this is a simple case, in about 1 out of 161, which would be about 0.16%. But remember, this pattern wasn't just high, low, 9 times. This was high, low, nine times, where the ratio was 1.5 to 1, okay? And that would only occur one out of 100,000 times. Okay, so bottom line, we had found this very important opportunity from a numerical standpoint in a county which had low number of Republican votes, where we could really see this pattern come out. And most people in pattern recognition call this a unicorn. You're very fortunate when you find this. So here we're finding out that this possibility would only be one in 100,000. How would this occur? The good news is, with mathematics, you can actually figure out how. The only way that pattern could occur was if my votes were multiplied by 0.666. And if you look at my opponent's pattern, he would have to be multiplied by 1.2. So that's the only way that you could have this. So what that means is, anyone, my vote, or anyone who voted for me, their votes were 2/3 of a person, okay? The 3/5 compromise, which back in 1787, basically said slaves were 3/5 of a vote. Dred Scott in the 1800s reaffirmed the fact that a slave was only 3/5 of a vote. It took until 1964, with the famous one person, one vote ruling by Justice Earl Warren, to say that one person must have one vote. And what we're seeing here is that the weighted race feature was turned on to multiply my votes by 2/3 and my opponent's votes by 1.2. So what we did, and by the way, this became a central part of our affidavit, which we filed in federal court in my second lawsuit, which is a one person, one vote lawsuit. And in that lawsuit, we've asked to decertify the 2020 Senate election. We've asked for a hand recount, and we shared all of this evidence. And in fact, we went and recalculated. So in Suffolk County, I win by the same percentage as in Franklin County. And in fact, in every county, you see me when I de-weight the votes: Norfolk County, Middlesex County, Berkshire County, Worcester County, Essex County. And when you de-weight the votes, I win by around 10 points, okay? Just like in Franklin County, which was a hand-counted county. Most importantly, this entire mathematical analysis, it's been filed in federal court. The opposition, which is the Secretary of State, filed close to 100 to 200 page opposition brief. The next victory we got, the judge denied their motion to dismiss. You have to understand, those of you who are wondering if election fraud takes place, you may have heard of a lot of dismissals taking place in many of the other cases. Our two cases are in federal court, the only two cases that are alive, both of which have not been dismissed. The first case on the First Amendment, where we got a victory on the restraining order, and the second case where the Secretary of State's motion was denied, their motion to dismiss was denied. So this shows that the federal courts and the judge believes there is significant merit. And more importantly, no mathematician has rebutted our actual affidavit. There's a lot of mathematicians in Massachusetts, a lot of very smart people in Cambridge. And what gets really important to our situation here is the Secretary of State of Massachusetts, by the way, who is now the president of the National Association of State Election Directors. At that time, she was a president-elect. In her affidavit, in our second lawsuit, look what she says here. She has lied under oath. What she says is, I have confirmed with vendors of the ImageCast and DS200 voting equipment that scanning functionality was disabled for the September 1st state primary and November 3rd general elections, and that no ballot images were created. This woman is saying that the electronic voting machines do not create ballot images. The prevarication is so deep in this, because if you don't create ballot images, you cannot count votes. There's nothing to tabulate. So this is a sworn testimony. Now, we found one of the election commissioners right here in Tennessee, Benny Smith. And Benny Smith, we found one of the election commissioners, Benny Smith, who has the actual brochure, because he's the one who's, for example, reviewing Dominion in Tennessee. And what does it say here? It says clearly that digital ballot images are made of every ballot's cast. In fact, here is a testimony of Eric Comer, Mr. Comer, in a previous lawsuit. What does he state? He says, regardless of whether it is hand-marked or the QR ballot, the scanners first take a digital image of both sides of the ballot. Bottom line, on any electronic voting machine, you must create a ballot image. Otherwise, there's nothing to be tabulated. So the state election director, and by the way, all of these state election directors who are deleting ballot images, telling you, the public, that ballot images are not being created, they're absolutely lying. And this is because with ballot images, we can clearly show that computer algorithms are in place. Without ballot images, you need a rocket scientist like myself to do all this calculation. And here is Benny Smith's affidavit. This comes out of the 2002 GEMS voting manual. Clearly says there's a weighted race feature. In fact, this is June 27th of one. And now, to those of you wondering, well, maybe that was back in 2001 or two. Does a weighted race feature exist today? Well, here's right out of the 2019 user's manual, the Dominion user's manual. What does it say? In the current manual, they call it the STV ranked choice voting. And you can see right here, they say single transferable voting, more specifically the weighted inclusive Gregory method. So that weighted race feature also exists in 2019-12. That was in the Diebold manual. Remember, Diebold was a grandfather of most of these electronic voting machines. And you see here, it also exists in the modern Dominion voting systems. The great news here is in our second lawsuit, as you can see here, the judge denied their motion to dismiss our motion. Again, two victories we've gotten in Massachusetts, which helps not only educate you that this is a real phenomenon, but a federal judge has supported both of our lawsuits by not allowing them to dismiss our lawsuits. So, by the way, all of this occurred long before the election fraud with Trump-Biden. So when all of this occurred, I was poised to help out. So when in Michigan, for example, what we see here is a Trump-Biden Michigan election fraud. I was fortunate working with some great people to get this data together, and we were able to apply this pattern analysis again to Michigan. And what do you notice here? In Michigan, there's two types of voting. You can vote for individually. So you can say, you can just vote for whoever you want. So whether you're Republican, Democrat, you go in and you vote for whoever you want. That's called individual voting. But in Michigan, there's an interesting voting methodology. You can also vote by party, which means you can vote by party, which means you can just say, I'm just going to vote for all Republican or I'm going to vote for all Democrat. Okay? So you can vote individually, you can be an individual, or you can say, I'm just going to vote straight party Republican or straight party Democrat. So remember, in pattern recognition, we try to figure out a feature. So the feature, and by the way, every precinct in Michigan tracks straight party voting as well as they track individual voting. So what we did was we calculated a variable to track, which was, the variable was, you track the, on the y-axis, the, in the case of President Trump, you track the number of, in a precinct, number of people voted for him individually, minus the number of people voted for him straight party. Now, theoretically, that number should be zero, right? Because people who vote straight party and the percentage of people who vote individually, that should be near zero. And so that's on the x-axis, we track that. And on the y-axis, we go from precincts that are not Republican, 0% is Republican. We order them to precincts on the far right, which are 100% Republican, all right? So this is a graph that we can build. It's called a feature. So as you can see here, a single point is, so if you have a precinct that's 60% Republican vote, you can see a difference here of 5%. So as you're going left to right, you have precincts which are highly Democrat, middle, which precincts which are Democrat and independents. On the far right, you should have the Republican precincts. Now, in this graph, the normal state, let's look at it. So here's data from Jefferson County looking at Jeff Sessions' election in Jefferson County. And what do you see here? You should get this beautiful parabolic pattern as you go from left to right. Okay? So this is a normal election. Here you see John McCain's election. And again, you see the beautiful parabolic pattern, all right? And then here's in Saginaw County in Michigan. No cheating took place. You get the nice parabolic pattern. However, again, remember pattern analysis, you're looking for the normal pattern, and then you're looking for the abnormal pattern. And in this pattern, if you were to look at it, as you're seeing in this graph here, you get really three systems of lines. One line going up, a flat line, and the bottom line, sloping line coming down. That forms this parabola, or at least the components of it. And this beautifully sort of shows what that parabola looks like, made up of really three different functions. what's interesting here, so that's a normal state, okay? So if you were to normally look at it, you should get this beautiful parabola if you plot this data. However, when you go to the abnormal state, look at what we see in Oakland County in Michigan. And by the way, when we did this video, some of you may have seen, I think it went to around 10 to 20 million people, because we showed here, what do you get in Oakland County in early voting? When we look at the same graph, you get a straight line. And same here in election day. And what you actually find is that near, and then you also see that here, what you find that this is just a line. It's not supposed to be a line. You're supposed to have that parabolic arc. It's missing the features. It's missing all those beautiful curves. It's completely linear, a straight line. In fact, when you look back at Oakland County, you find out that Biden essentially got 60,000 votes when that line was applied. 30,000 votes were taken from Trump. 30,000 votes were given to Biden. So that's a 60,000 lead Biden got by the application of that straight line versus what should be a parabola. Go to Macomb County. Same thing here. You find out in this case, there was nearly 33,000 vote lead, which was about, you know, 16,500 votes were taken from President Trump, 16,000 votes given to Biden at that time, okay? Total of 33,000 votes. And same here, Kent County is quite dramatic. You see the line is even more magnificent here, and about 40,000 votes total deficit, which is a lead that Biden got. So in total, you're looking about 138,000 votes just in those three, across those three major counties. So what it looks like is President Trump loses votes in direct proportion to the percentage of Republicans in a precinct. So it's too linear, very simply put. To keep it very simple, I mean, we can get into all the algorithms underlying this, and others have done some very complex stuff, but you don't even need to go there to understand it's a straight line. And it should never be a straight line. It should never have a constant slope. Nothing in nature is a straight line. So this is why it's clear weighted race was imposed on this, because you cannot get a straight line. And so this is what the normal state should look like, but what we get is we get a beautiful straight line. So again, going back to the cardiology example, you should get this very complex wave, not a sinusoid. And so I like to say it simply, it's like a parabola went into the voting booth and out came a line. That's what happened in Michigan. Now, in Maricopa County, I did a different analysis in the Trump-Biden case, and there's a detailed video many of you can see on this. But what's important in Maricopa County was we were able to really look at demographics and do a demographic analysis. If you look at in Maricopa County, around 2 million people voted. 49.8% of people went to Biden. 47.6% of people went to Trump. Now, that county has Republicans, around 35%. It's got Democrats, around 31%. It has independents, nearly 32%, 1.1% Libertarian. So that's how you get the total number. So what we did in Maricopa County was we literally, first of all, recreated the election. That's what you're seeing in this graph here. You see the blue line, which literally looks at the entire, that's Trump's Trump election, and the blue is Biden. There's blue's 49.8%, and you see Trump at 47.8%, okay? So this is the actual election we recreated. Then what we did with the power of the computer, we looked at how could we get that exact curve to fit perfectly. So we went through hundreds of thousands of simulations varying the percentage of Democrats that Trump and Biden got, the percentage of Republicans Trump and Biden got, people are not party, libertarian, etc. And here's an example. So you're seeing here, this is one example. It's not fitting the curve. You see another example, it's not fitting. You see another example. And like this, we ran many, many simulations, as you're seeing here. Well, finally, we found a certain combination which fit perfectly. Well, in order for that to fit perfectly, what you found is that Trump had to get negative 30% Democrats and Biden had to get 130% Democrats. Let me repeat that again. Biden had to get 130% Democrats. Trump had to get negative 30% Democrats. And that's what you see here, which is frankly highly unlikely, and which means Democrat votes of Trump were transferred to Biden. So how is this result possible? Again, to be fair, to apply the scientific method, one possibility is there's a demographic within the independent voters that are not visible in our model who voted for Biden. Another possibility is if Biden's votes were multiplied by 1.3, 130%, meaning each single vote that Biden actually received became 1.3 reported votes, and President Trump's votes are reduced by 0.3, or 30% gained by Mr. Biden. So simply put, this is vote swapping. Or a combination of both is possible. But what's clear is, when you look at the actual election, the only way we were able to reproduce that, and if others can find it, we're open to it, but the only way we could find that by running hundreds of thousands of simulations was that one combination. Briefly put in Trump in Georgia, Trump Biden in Georgia, what we found was, very simply put, high Republican, low Trump. And I can get more into details on this, but the net of it is, if you look at Fulton County, as you get into more and more Republican precincts, less and less Trump votes. And when we try to recreate Fulton County, for example, using the same approach, what do we find? The only way this is possible is if Trump got only 2% of the black votes and Biden got 98%, okay? Which is quite unlikely. Same thing in Forsyth County, same thing in Cobb County, same thing in Cherokee County. What you find is when you aggregate all these counties, it's high Republican, low Trump, consistently in every county. So my position on this is, when you look at our lawsuits and what I see is, we are violating the principle of one person, one vote, which is why my parents came to this country, which is why we as Americans value what we have in the U.S. Constitution, particularly the Fifth and the 14th Amendment. And what we have now today is the electronic voting systems, with the fact that the weighted race feature is in those voting systems, it means that we can be denied one person, one vote. The only way out of this, as a technologist, as a guy who's got 4 degrees from MIT, the only way out of this is to go back to, at the local precinct level, hand-counted paper ballots where it's counted at the precinct, tabulated at the precinct, and reported at the precinct. Because by the time the vote, you get the vote counts, where they're deleting ballot images, where they're being transported to a central facility, that's where a lot of application of weighted race algorithms like what we've observed could take place. And so we need, in order to have one person, one vote, we need to make sure the inputs coming in, the P, the number of voters, match the V. And the only way I can think, to my best knowledge and as an engineer, is we must go back to hand-counted paper ballots, transparent voting, where we have permanent voter registration cards that the software, if we're going to use software, it's open source or it's hand counted, and it's hand marked paper ballots, and the ballot images must be saved, and we should publish them up to the cloud, and we need to have automatic audits. But without this, we really do not have one person, one vote in the United States anymore. That is why our lawsuits, which have survived in Massachusetts, are critical, because their surviving, their fact that they did not get dismissed, should show to everyone that the unrebutted mathematical evidence clearly shows that the Secretary of State, at least in Massachusetts and probably across the United States, do not want you to know that they're deleting ballot images, which are the evidence of computer algorithms. Our work in Massachusetts, the work we've done in Michigan, Georgia, and Maricopa County clearly show the existence of computer algorithms, period. Thank you for listening. Again, this is Dr. Shiva Ayyadure. And to just let you know, I'm an MIT PhD with 4 degrees, and I'm the inventor of email. And I hope you guys go check us out at vashiva.com, victoryalphashiva.com, to learn more.